No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008, or you can send a question to our chat box and we'll ask our guest. And tonight we have a very special guest, Dr. Daryl West. And Dr. West is a vice president and director of governance studies and a senior fellow at the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. He is also, before he came to Brookings, he was John Hazen White Professor of Political Science and Public Policy and the director of the Taubman Center for Public Policy at Brown University. He is also the author of dozens of articles and books and briefings, including about the Electoral College, which we want to talk to him about tonight. Welcome, Dr. West. Welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Senator, nice to be with you.
Yeah. Well, let's start, you know, with the Electoral College. What's wrong with the Electoral College? Dr. West, tell us.
Wait, before we go there, West, could you give our listeners a brief overview of just what the Electoral College is, why it was started, and then we can go into what may or may not be right or wrong about it? Because not everybody knows. I did research, of course, for the broadcast, and I learned things that I didn't know. And I think maybe if you could give broad overview for our listeners, that would be of relevance.
Certainly, Maria. Happy to do that. So,
thank you.
You know, some people might think that we have direct popular election of the presidency, but of course that is not the case. We have an electoral college that actually chooses the president. And if there is a difference between the popular vote and the electoral college, as has happened twice in the last five presidential elections, whoever wins the electoral college actually becomes a president. And the way that it operates is each state has a number of electoral college delegates equivalent to the number of senators, so that's two from each state, plus the number of House members. So larger states have more House members, so they have a greater representation in the Electoral College. And the norm is that whoever wins the popular vote in a particular state gets all of the Electoral College votes of that particular state. And so we have our regular election in November. The Electoral College meets in December, and it's, you know, whoever gets a majority of the Electoral College becomes the president.
So how has that been not consistent twice in the last five elections? What happened in those two instances?
So in 2000, of course, we had a contested election between George W. Bush and Al Gore, and it centered on basically who had won the state of Florida, and that election went all the way to the Supreme Court, and basically they decided that Bush had won Florida, which then gave Bush a majority in the Electoral College. So he became president, even though he actually lost the popular vote. In 2016, we had a similar thing in the sense that Donald Trump won the Electoral College, even though he lost the popular vote by a couple million votes. So he became the president.
Well, first of all, thanks, Maria, for answering that. You know, I've been in politics 40 years, so I assume that people know these things, but they don't necessarily. So thanks for that. And let me answer the second part of the question. And Dr. West, you tell me if I'm wrong, because I just finished reading again, Federalist 68. The Federalist Papers were kind of a PR piece that was put out there by the founding fathers to get people to support the Constitution. And in that piece, Hamilton, I think, suggests, and Dr. West, you're the expert, but he seems to me to suggest that this is a safeguard, that he sees that they see the Electoral College as a safeguard to make sure that things don't go awry in the popular vote. And we know the founding fathers were very much into this, right? They were very much into control. They didn't want certain groups of people to vote. They didn't want, certainly the District of Columbia to vote, to have say over elections. So it seems to me that that was the reason for it. But tell us now, Doctor, what your opinion is of the Electoral College, please.
I mean, personally, I think it is time to get rid of the Electoral College just because, you know, we're starting to see a discrepancy between who wins the popular vote versus who wins the Electoral College. That makes people angry when someone who did not get the most votes actually becomes a president. So the fact that that has happened twice out of the last five presidential elections is a problem. But you're also right when you start to kind of think about the historical ramifications. The Electoral College originally was set up as a compromise between the big and the small states. Like then, back then, everybody worried about the big states like New York and Pennsylvania and Virginia dominating the new country. The smaller states did not want that to happen. So they came up with this a compromise that gave larger states greater representation in the Electoral College, but then every state had two senators, and so that was a way to kind of equalize things with the small states. But then the second compromise involved in choosing the chief executive. There were some people who wanted Congress to make that choice, you know, kind of like a prime minister model in a parliamentary system. There are others who wanted state legislatures to actually pick that, and they basically deadlocked on that. And so they came up with the idea of the Electoral College as a body of wise men. And I say men because, you know, women did not have the right to vote, so it was limited to men at that point in time. And they were designed to set up a body of independent judgment. Like, the founders actually wanted the Electoral College to deliberate and choose the right person, regardless of the popularity of that individual, regardless of the results of the popular vote. It was designed to basically have this small group of people exercise their judgment and choose the person who they thought was best, regardless of what the popular vote indicated.
Well, and you know, isn't that a natural political thing? I mean, I sit here as a superdelegate. I'm a superdelegate to the convention, and I was at the DNC when they created superdelegates, and they did it for exactly the same reason. They did it to give the party, right, the party elite kind of control, like a safety valve or something, and it never really came into play until recently, and that's come under a lot of criticism. For the same reason you mentioned about people being angry that a handful of people can step in and change the popular process of nominating a candidate for president. But can I ask you what's changed? The small states still seem to argue that. Some of them, anyway. If you get rid of the Electoral College, they'll be ignored. I'm a campaigner. Why won't I just go to California and New York and Chicago with no Electoral College?
Well, the critics are right in the sense that under our current system, basically the swing states are the most important ones. Like, basically 40 out of the 50 states are pretty predictable in terms of how they're going to cast their votes, either for the Republican or the Democratic candidate, that in most of the recent elections, we've had 10 or 12 swing states, and the candidates spend all their time, all their advertising money, their personal time visiting those particular states. So, you know, it's the big Midwestern states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, a few of the southern states, Florida and Georgia, Nevada, Iowa, sometimes New Mexico. This year, Arizona is considered a swing state. So if we got rid of the Electoral College tomorrow and moved to direct popular election, the candidates certainly would devote more attention to the big states. They would still be focusing just on probably about a dozen states, but it would be a different dozen than what we have now. So it's certainly reasonable to worry about the fact that the general election would focus on 10 or 12 states, but that's pretty much the situation we have right now. It's just it's a different 10 or 12 than might be true if we had direct popular voting.
Could I ask how it is possible that somebody wins the popular vote but doesn't win the electoral vote? So my guess is that they win a state by a simple majority, but the rest then is the popular vote that went to the opposition, and then those numbers accumulate, and that's how that is possible?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. And in 2016, for example, what really helped Hillary Clinton win the popular vote was she got really big votes out of New York, California, and you know a few other large states, so that she was able to win a majority of the popular vote. But then, you know, she lost Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and that was just enough to allow Trump to win the Electoral College. And so, you know, we could actually end up in the same situation this year where you could have Biden winning California, New York by big margins. Texas is competitive in a way that it has not been in the past. So there's a really good chance Biden is going to win the popular vote. But if Trump can hold on to those battleground states in the Midwest, you know, he could still win the Electoral College. So, you know, there's always that possibility, but that's pretty much how it happened. You know, really big victories in a few of the really large states, allowing somebody to win the popular vote, but not winning the Electoral College.
Let me ask you, how much power do the electors actually have? You know, we had a situation in Washington, D.C., because we're not a state, and we were, you know, you understand our representation here in the district. We had an elector that refused to cast her vote a few years ago because she said it was, you know, we're just, the whole system is corrupt in her opinion. And she wouldn't cast her vote because we didn't have representation. But that's the only time I've ever heard of that happening. Do the electors have any real flexibility, or are they required by state law to vote for whoever won the state?
Well, there have been, the last time I checked, there have been 157 times in American history where there was this so-called faithless elector, meaning an elector who did not respect the popular vote in his or her home state.
Wow.
And basically voted for someone else, or, you know, wrote in somebody's name. So it does happen. In most elections, it's a handful, like, you know, a very few people who do that. In 2016, I think we almost had a dozen people who did that.
Wow.
And as it has started to happen, states have started to pass laws basically demanding or mandating that their electors, if it's a Republican elector and the Republican has won the popular vote in that state, that they have to vote for whoever won the popular vote there. But there actually was a very interesting Supreme Court case that just was decided a few months ago, because we had cases in 2016, and I think there were examples both in Colorado and in Washington where basically the states mandate that the elector has to respect the popular vote in that particular state, but there were electors who refused to do that. So there were court cases that came out of that, and the Supreme Court basically allowed states to mandate that people had to respect the popular vote. So that actually has eliminated what could have been an ambiguous situation for 2020, that as long as the state has that requirement, those electors are going to have to follow that dictate.
So the District of Columbia gets three electors. How is that determined? Do you know?
Constitutional amendment.
Okay.
The 23rd Amendment gives us the number of electors of the smallest state. So if the population, as the doctor has pointed out, you get two votes for your senators and votes for your representatives. If we ended up having 3 million people living in the District of Columbia and we got five, we were entitled to five electors, we wouldn't get them because the constitutional amendment limits us to three.
And then, Dr. West, the District of Columbia and the majority of the other states do something about binding their electors to the vote. Is that what you were referencing earlier?
Yes. A number of states have moved in that direction because they don't want there to be faithless electors who refuse to respect the popular vote in that particular state. And that was the issue in this recent Supreme Court decision that basically upheld those types of laws. So any state that wants to ensure that the electors cast the vote in keeping with the popular vote majority, all they have to do is pass a law, and those electors will be required to do that.
And then there's Maine and Nebraska that use something is called a district system. Can you explain?
Yes, Maine and Nebraska are exceptions in the sense that every other state, it's winner take all, whoever wins a popular vote for the state as a whole. Maine and Nebraska do it at the level of the congressional district. And so it's whoever wins the particular congressional district. Mm. So you can have a split outcome of, like in Maine, someone may win one of the congressional districts while the other candidate wins the second congressional district. And so the Electoral College vote gets split based on the congressional district vote as opposed to the statewide vote.
Would that be better to change our entire national system to something like that? Because you're getting more granular when you do that.
You do get more granular, but you can also still end up with a disparity between the Electoral College and the popular vote. So my personal preference is just to get rid of the Electoral College and move to direct popular election. I just think, you know, we're used to whoever wins a popular vote wins the office. You know, that's how we do House elections, Senator races, gubernatorial elections, and so on. Like, the presidency is really unusual in the sense it's the only major office that does not abide by the popular vote.
You know, a question that I have is, on the surface of this, Dr. West, it seems very reasonable to say that the person that gets the most votes should win. But our government and our system of governance has a lot of these things, does it not? For example, there's no equity in senators. The people from California get less senator than the people from Rhode Island, right? Because they represent senators
per capita,
in California.
Right?
Yeah. People in California get they have one senator represent millions of people, whereas the people of Rhode Island probably have a senator for every several hundred thousand people. So, and there's a lot of that. And of course, the district is the same way. We don't have the same races. So there's a lot of, aren't there many instances of this in the way we govern?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of inequity up and down the line, and certainly the examples that you just gave are near the top of the list. I mean, the Senate has almost become an anti-majoritarian kind of institution for the reason that you give. You know, California has, I don't know, whatever, 36 million people, and it has two senators. Rhode Island has 1 million people, and it has two senators. So the small states are overrepresented there. And, of course, what is happening now is you basically have the Senate bottling up legislation that public opinion polls suggest, you know, 65 or 70% of Americans might want. You know, gun control, immigration reform, and you can kind of go down the list. But the Senate doesn't have to take popular preferences into the Senate, whereas the House tends to be
the
more
connection
representative.
Could you hear was getting
more
worse?
The population.
Maybe Doug
and so
will have
when
to,
the population
to oh, there
shift
are.
In a certain way on an issue, then the House members tend to vote in the same way. Senators do not face the same type of pressures, and you can end up with a small number of people basically blocking action that two-thirds of Americans might want.
Well, I had somebody send me put into our chat box the question that I'd like you to address. In New York, for example, they said in the last election that Trump won the majority of counties. He won the vast majority of counties in New York, but he lost the popular vote because of New York City. And this guy's question is, why should a handful, millions of people that live in Manhattan decide for the entire state when the state people that live outside Manhattan have chosen another candidate? Do you think that's unfair somehow? We don't get the right representation, of the issues. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I mean, that's purely a function of the one person, one vote rule. People in Manhattan have a lot of say just because there are a lot of people who live in Manhattan. And the Manhattan vote and kind of the surrounding counties around New York City, that's where the bulk of the population is. So, if you move to a county-based rule, it would end up overrepresenting people who live in rural areas and create, even bigger inequities because people who live in cities would be underrepresented. So I personally would not favor moving to that type of rule. Although the point the person made actually is true. I don't know the exact numbers, but I believe in 2016, Trump won probably more than three quarters of the counties in America. It's the reason why on election night, when you look at the map, it's like the map really looks red because Republicans do well, but they're doing well in states that in the middle of the country that don't have a lot of population. But that's how they can do well in the Electoral College, because if you win a bunch of states, you can do well in the Electoral College, even if you're losing the popular vote.
Yeah, and I worked for Jimmy Carter on his reelection, and that certainly happened to us. They refer to Reagan's election as a landslide. He really didn't win by that many votes, but he won every state. I mean, I think Georgia and D.C. and Minnesota were the only states he didn't win. I think that happens more times than we really recognize sometimes. Well, how do we get rid of it? Who gets rid of it? Congress, if we want to get rid of it, who gets rid of it? Congress has to pass a law. We have to amend the Constitution. What do we do?
Well, the complication here is the Electoral College is embedded in the U.S. Constitution. So to really get rid of it in a definitive way is going to require a constitutional amendment. And basically that means, if I remember exactly, I think it's three quarters of the House and Senate have to vote in favor of it, and then two thirds of the states have to approve that. So it's obviously a very lengthy and complicated process to amend the Constitution, and that pretty much, would be the cleanest way to do it. But there is a compromise proposal. It's called the Compact Proposal, in which basically there are states that are agreeing to cast their electors for the person who wins the national popular vote. But it's contingent on there has to be enough states to approve that provision so that it would actually garner a majority in the Electoral College. So we're not at that point yet. A number of states have signed off on that. But that would actually be a way informally for states to cooperate to get rid of the Electoral College in practice and basically respect the popular vote without amending the Constitution. So that is kind of one workaround that has been suggested, just because, you know, it takes so long to amend the Constitution on anything.
And yeah. Who would take that up? Would a political party take it on, or would an independent think tank or a PAC, or who would you see leading that?
Well, anybody can suggest an idea that would lead to amending the Constitution, but ultimately the House and the Senate have to vote in large numbers to approve it, and then state legislatures have to approve it. So they're the ones that have the real power in terms of a constitutional amendment actually being added.
Because I would think that this could be a Democrat cause, since Al Gore lost and Hillary Clinton lost, in the more recent history, that it could become a political thing.
It certainly could. You know, if we end up in 2020 with three out of the last six presidential elections, there being a difference between the popular vote and the Electoral College, certainly a lot of Democrats will be very upset about that, since in each of those three elections, it was the Republican who won and not the Democrat. But ultimately, because you need supermajorities in the House and Senate and among the states, it can't be a partisan issue because there will not be enough support to actually amend the Constitution. You know, it has to be an issue that is seen both by Republicans and Democrats as a problem. And the funny thing is, in the near future, even though right now more Democrats support getting rid of the Electoral College compared to Republicans, that could actually change within a couple of presidential elections. And the change that would actually lead Republicans to move in favor of getting rid of the Electoral College would be if Texas actually truly becomes competitive or becomes a state where Democrats can win at the presidential level. Because if you basically have Democrats being in a position where, like now, they're easily winning California and New York and Illinois and a few other big states, and if you add Texas to that list, it basically means a Republican presidential candidate would never be able to win the Electoral College. When we hit that point and Texas truly becomes competitive at the presidential level, you're going to have Republicans join this bandwagon and want to get rid of the Electoral College.
That's a great perspective.
You know, I don't know what's happened in recent years with the growth of independence, but 40 years ago, when I was at the Democratic Committee, there were two Democrats for every Republican in America. So I would think the Democrats would, yeah, they'd be happy to get rid of it. In those days anyway, no Republican could win a national election without the support of either independents or Democrats. I'd like Maria, we have an expert on tech policy and mass media on the show, and I know that's your area. So why don't you start off, now that we're about halfway through the show, why don't you start off with some questions that you might have in those areas?
Sure. And one thing, though, that I would like to follow up with you, Dr. West, is why is it that you see Texas as being a little fluid now? It's most definitely not the red as it once was. Do you see it as purple yet? Or what factors are coming into play for you to make that assessment about the state of Texas?
I mean, in this year, public opinion polling is still showing Trump having a slight edge over Biden in Texas, but it's pretty competitive. And, you know, it has been a long time since Democrats had any hope of even coming close in Texas. I mean, Texas typically is a very easy state for Republican presidential candidates. So this year could be an exception just because of Trump's unpopularity. But in moving forward, as we head to 2024 and 2028, because of immigration, Texas is starting to become a more competitive state, purple state, as you suggest, because of the demographic trends there. And so Democrats do believe that in the not very distant future, Texas is going to be competitive at the presidential level. Now, we don't know if it's going to be 2020, 2024, or maybe by 2028, but it is certainly going to become competitive in the not very distant future.
Thank you for that. So, as Michael was saying, I'm curious about the book that you wrote about going mobile, how wireless technology is reshaping our lives. So my PhD is in media psychology, and so that's what we study, technology and the user experience and the psychology behind it. We call them the black mirrors, be they tablets or phones or what have you. And so that's right in my sweet spot. So I'm curious if you could just maybe summarize what that was like, and then people can buy it and read it.
Yeah, we do a lot of work on digital technology in general. So I had this book on going mobile. I think it was 2 years ago. I had a book called The Future of Work that looks at whether technology is going to end up taking all the jobs. So that's something that people worry about. And then 2 weeks ago, Brookings President John Allen and I just had a new book come out on artificial intelligence. It's called Turning Point. And I'd say in all of these projects, what we're trying to do is to, one, recognize the technology revolution is accelerating, certainly in terms of mobile devices, that has been the case. But, you know, now we're seeing in terms of the use of robots in factories, there are retail outlets that are basically being fully automated, so no sales clerks there. Artificial intelligence is becoming more widespread in many different sectors. And so what we're trying to figure out is just, you know, how is this going to affect people? What are the problems that we're going to see through technology, either in terms of the impact on the workforce, the impact on privacy, how it affects security, you know, is it going to increase inequality? Is it going to increase bias in the way these algorithms operate? Because there's already evidence that that is happening, at least in some areas. So we're trying to figure out, you know, what are the problems through digital technology, and then how we can address them. Like, what are the policy remedies? And of course, a couple weeks ago, we had this amazing congressional hearing with the CEOs of Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google having to testify, and there certainly were a lot of problems that were raised there. So we're focused both on trying to figure out what the problems are and then what we can do about them and what the possible remedies would be.
So since you mentioned artificial intelligence and that everything that I, the research that I've done about artificial intelligence and big data suggests that there aren't any ethics involved in the decisions that is being made about how to use them and the algorithms. Can you speak to that?
Well, over the last 30 years, since the technology revolution has started to unfold, America has pretty much had a libertarian stance towards the technology sector, in which we allow private companies to make all of the important decisions. Like, they decide what products to develop, when to deploy them, to whom to sell them. I mean, basically, there are very few regulations in the technology sector, which is unlike virtually every other sector. Like in healthcare, there are a bunch of regulations in education. There's a regulation in the energy area. The technology sector has not been subject to that much oversight. But what we're now starting to see in our Turning Point book, John Allen and I talk about the techlash, the backlash against technology that is now starting to emerge. People are now worried about a whole host of problems in the technology area in terms of bias, lack of transparency, the impact on humans, the possible impact on the workforce. And basically, they're starting to want more oversight of the technology sector. Like, right now, we're already seeing several states and localities take action in this area. So California passed a major privacy rule that imposes a bunch of new regulations on the technology sector. There are some cities that have imposed rules on Airbnb and wanting to limit, you know, people's ability just to rent rooms or apartments on their own. There are some cities that have banned the use of facial recognition by law enforcement. There are states that are moving to regulate the gig economy, Right now, a lot of companies basically don't pay health care benefits for their workers because they say they're independent contractors, not full-time employees, and so therefore they don't have to provide health care and or retirement benefits. So at the state and local level, we're actually starting to see a number of new regulations. And if we end up after the 2020 election with a Democratic president, Democratic House, and Democratic Senate, there's likely to be a lot of action at the national level in terms of starting to think about new rules. So that's something we're certainly paying close attention to and trying to monitor what is happening.
Well, and to that effect, one more question, Michael, sorry. The EU in May of 2018 enacted that you have to opt in instead of opting out, for example, and they did this overarching, really, I think, great way to protect people's integrity and their privacy. Now we have where you see they say we use cookies and you have to agree that you're going to let them use whatever it is that you're searching. Why do you think we haven't done that as the United States?
The Europeans have been at the forefront of imposing a number of new regulations on the tech sector, and certainly their privacy rules are moving in that direction as well. We have not done it because basically we are allowing the technology companies to make most of the major decisions. But I do believe that is starting to change. And the fact that California passed this major privacy bill, it doesn't go quite as far as the European approach, but it certainly moves much more in that direction than ever has been the case before. And in our book, we argue that that's really a precursor of what we think is going to happen in the coming years, that, you know, Americans are worried about privacy, they're worried about the job impact, they're worried about issues of racial bias in algorithms, and we're going to start developing rules that provide some guardrails to protect people from technology that hasn't been very accountable.
Let me ask you a philosophical question. This is something that came up while I was in college. We were asked to compare intelligence with knowledge. And I think in the end, we decided that intelligence was something that evolved over a long period of time, whereas knowledge was something that progressed geometrically. And are we smart enough to handle the technology that we're producing? In those days, we were talking about nuclear bombs, for example. We could make lots of nuclear bombs, but were we smart enough and mature enough to know how to handle them? How do you think about social media as it's developing, and it's going to have more of an impact on this election probably than it's ever had in the past? Are we smart enough to handle it? Are we smart enough to keep the Russians and the Chinese out of our election? Or is it developing faster than we have the capacity to deal with it?
I actually think we are smart enough to handle the problems that, you know, we're already seeing, certainly in terms of foreign interference, social media manipulation, and other associated things. The problem, I think, is not lack of smartness. It's lack of political will. You know, it's been hard to get Congress to take this issue of foreign interference seriously. There are lots of things we could do. You know, the Department of Homeland Security could provide much more intensive training for state and local election officials just so they can spot possible problems and anticipate ways that their systems could be attacked. We could issue reports kind of outlining in detail, you know, what the Russians did in 2016, what they did in 2018, and now, you know, we're starting to see evidence of them doing similar things in 2020. There are lots of things we could do to really protect our systems. It's just we're not doing them. I mean, that's the thing that concerns me. I think we actually know what we should be doing, but we're not doing it, and we're not providing the funding to help state and local officials really gear up and protect their election infrastructure.
Well, and that's what I'm afraid that something egregious is going to happen, and we're going to go, holy hell, what were we thinking? And, you know, it's a little bit too much, too little, too late. But especially that's why I asked you about the ethics, like with facial recognition drones, anybody can be taken out anywhere in the world. I mean, that technology exists. I've seen it in action. And I did a report on somebody who was searching on the internet. They were buying a deep fat fryer for their grandmother for the birthday. And that information got bundled into an insurance company who decided that the person who was doing the search had an unhealthy lifestyle and then was given a surcharge for their health insurance premiums because of their what they were surfing the net for. And the same true with, with the driverless cars. There's AI involved with Tesla, right, Dr. West?
Yes, absolutely.
And so when that vehicle makes a decision to not hit the pedestrian that's walking across the street and to jump the curb and hit the person that's on the sidewalk, that's an algorithm that it has been programmed to do.
Wow. Yes, and there certainly are lots of ways in which algorithms are making bad decisions or making decisions where there's little accountability for how the code is written. And in our Turning Point book, we actually have a whole chapter on ethics where we argue that companies need to hire ethicists to help them think about these types of issues. They need to develop an AI ethics code. They need an AI review board that can review product development and product deployment early in the process, as opposed to kind of putting these algorithms out in the world. Problems start to develop, and then companies think, how can we deal with these problems? Like, they need to anticipate that there's going to be negative consequences for people, and we need to address the ethical aspects of those issues before the products actually get released. So there's a lot that we could do, and some companies actually are starting to move in this direction, but we just need to get much more serious about this.
Well, can we give the example about the company that created something that then that company sold to the Department of Defense, and the engineers were like, wait, we didn't develop this for a war or to kill people, but when you work for a company, you don't own the intellectual property, and they could do what they wanted to do.
Yep. There are workplace rebellions that are taking place in some of the tech companies where the average workers worry about how their own products are being used by federal agencies. And sometimes it's in the defense area, sometimes it's customs and border patrol, and how immigration issues are being addressed. So there certainly is some internal dissent within a number of these companies. But, there are other companies that are moving full steam ahead, developing products, selling them to various federal agencies. And so I think what we need to do is, for Congress really to get serious about looking at these problems. And I think the hearings that have been conducted over the last year are a good step in that direction, just in the sense of trying to figure out what's going on, what are the potential problems, and how we can address them. We just need to think about what are the guardrails that can protect us from the problems that we're already seeing with some of these technologies.
I want to change gears a little bit here, Dr. West. I can't have a guy on the show that's written an article called Checkbook Democracy and other things about money and politics and not ask you about money and politics. I used to be the FEC compliance officer for the DNC, and my humble opinion is that anybody, anywhere, should be able to give money to a national political election. Corporations, anybody, but nobody should be able to give more than $500. What do you think? Because I think money really corrupts.
Certainly, money in politics is a huge problem, and it's gotten much worse. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the Watergate reforms in the 1970s, where we developed public financing of campaigns, imposed limits on campaign contributions, had very sharp limits on political action committees. And basically, over the last several decades, kind of one by one, almost every one of those limitations has been either eliminated, or we've created loopholes, or the courts have struck those provisions down. And so what that has resulted in today is there's a complete Wild West in terms of campaign finance, where there's almost no restriction. You know, you can have billionaires spending tens of millions of dollars, and there's no limit on that. There's a complete lack of transparency. You know, it used to be you would have to report campaign contributions so at least people could know who was supporting a particular candidates. A lot of those disclosure requirements are gone, so it's possible for wealthy individuals or companies to give large amounts of money, and nobody even knows about it. So, you know, that clearly is a big problem. And so next year, you know, one of the first actions of Congress needs to be kind of election reform and campaign finance reform. And Congress has a bill, H.R. 1, which basically the House already has passed. And if Democrats get the Senate back, that will be one of the first bills that I think gets passed in 2021.
Yeah. I mean, it really needs to be done. I remember being at the DNC, you know, and there was a $20,000 cap on how much money you could give to national elections. And we would take in hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you know what we do with it? We put it, we mark it as training money or infrastructure building, something that didn't directly have to do with federal elections. So we called it non-federal money. And we had a big non-federal account. So I think as long as money comes in, there'll always be, you know, there'll always be loopholes. I think public finance and limiting everybody to a small amount is really, really the answer. Go ahead, Maria, ask the question.
Yes, Dr. West, I'm going to take us back to digital. Could you share with our listeners what you know about Sophia the robot and what, because not a lot of people know about her, and what you think that means for AI, and is there a future for that?
There is a future. The AI applications are getting more sophisticated. Robots are developing greater and greater capabilities. There are some factories today that are almost fully automated, so robots are being incorporated in the manufacturing process. There are robot caregivers that are basically taking on some of the responsibilities of nurses. I've been in restaurants where instead of ordering your food from a waiter or a waitress, you basically click on a mobile tablet and order electronically. So there's just all sorts of ways that AI, robots, and automation are taking over. And these trends are really going to accelerate in the next 5 to 10 years. So we need to be thinking about what it means for the workforce, what it's going to mean for jobs. We're clearly going to have to put a lot more effort into job retraining and worker redevelopment. In my Future of Work book, I talk about the concept of lifelong learning. Right now, we kind of invest in education up through about age 25, and then after that, people are on their own. In the future, people are going to have to develop their job skills at age 30, 40, 50, and 60. So we have to figure out a way for people to keep updating their job skills as they age.
And Sophia is actually, she looks like a human being, and she's mobile, and she learns. Are you familiar with her at all, Sophia?
She's also
citizen of the United of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I've read a little bit about it, and you know, clearly the robots are getting much more sophisticated and taking on tasks of increasing complexity.
Well, because she also blinks, she speaks, she has a sense of humor, she smiles. I mean, she looks like a human being, except for they left the back part of her head not covered in a flesh-like tone, and you can see the mechanisms spinning around the machinery, if you will. But if you can catch it, Michael, it's really eerie because she learns. They've trained her that the more she speaks, the more she gets subtlety and humor and that sort of thing. And because she's a robot, she travels all over the world. She doesn't have to worry about COVID. She's a guest on programs and everything else.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's pretty crazy.
She's a great ambassador for AI-led robots.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Well, the good news for you, Maria, since you're constantly in school, is you really don't have to worry about the re-education process because you're absolutely involved in it. And But I would imagine, Dr. West, that all of this stuff is going to go through massive acceleration, given where we are in the world today with like COVID, because technology is really, really what seems to be filling in for our need to social distance. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. I mean, COVID is going to accelerate many trends in favor of technology. So, you know, we're seeing a shift towards online education because, you know, schools are and teachers are worried about reopening. In the healthcare area, we're seeing the rise of telemedicine and video conferencing. I mean, I've had consultations with my doctor that were video conferences as opposed to in person. Many of us are now working at home, so we're telecommuting, and all those trends were there before COVID, but COVID is accelerating them. And so we're just going to see big moves in terms of adopting these. And even, you know, when we reach the point where we have a COVID vaccine or, you know, the numbers start to come down, many of these trends, I think, are here to stay. So it'll kind of show how COVID is transforming things. Like, even after we get it under control, these trends are still going to be here. Right. They're still going to affect people. And so we need to be thinking now about how to get a handle on this, how it's going to affect workers. Are there policy changes that we're going to need to make? I mean, there's just lots of things we need to start thinking through that we've not really done enough of to this point.
Well, this is really scary for a guy who just got an Apple Watch for his birthday and has spent the last day and a half trying to figure out how to make it tell time. So I'm not looking forward to the technological revolution. Go ahead.
So you're Exhibit A, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Well, that's because I'll speak for Michael and myself. We're digital immigrants. Yeah. And, you know, the digital natives, they have it all over us because that's the world they grew up in. I'm curious if you wouldn't mind sharing. I love the title of your book, Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. What's your takeaway from that?
That book was really a money and politics book. So it talked about the growing economic power of the ultra wealthy, but then also the accompanying political power. And I remember many years ago, I think this is back in the mid-1990s, Ted Turner came to Brown University to give a talk when I was teaching there. And he said something that always stayed with me. He said, you know, the first million is the hardest. And then after that, it's easy. Because basically, once you get money, you get into networks and everything just becomes easier. And that's really been the story of the last few decades. You know, income inequality is much higher, wealth concentration is higher. And so this is just another public policy issue that we're going to have to address, because in order for the country to move forward, we need a strong middle class. We need working class people need adequate health, education, and retirement benefits. And we can't have a real economic recovery unless it's an inclusive recovery that includes a wide variety of people. You know, we're seeing big racial disparities in COVID disease incidence levels as well as fatality levels. So COVID is kind of revealing a lot of inequities that were already there, but, you know, they're just becoming more apparent. So in the Billionaires book, I just kind of talk about wealth and how it's changing politics, how it's changed the election process, the impact that it's had on public policy. Although the book came out several years ago, I think the message is as relevant today as it was then.
I would imagine, with Soros and the Koch brothers and those sorts that have put lots of their fortune into politics.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is the Koch brothers have between, one of them has passed away.
But, yeah.
Their fortune was about $100 billion. And there have been elections where they've contributed $1 billion to that particular campaign. if you have $100 billion, your money can grow. If it grows 1%, that's $1 billion. If it grows 2%, that's $2 billion. Like, they can fund $1 billion expenditure basically out of the capital appreciation of their wealth, meaning mm-hmm. they could spend $1 billion and it doesn't reduce their net worth at all. And so that's kind of a scary realization, when you kind of think about the people who have, such extraordinary wealth and then their ability to translate that into political influence.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was just making the point that, we do have to worry about wealth concentration just because economic power gets translated into political power.
Mm-hmm. And does it make you sad or depressed that we're getting more and more that way? Or, I mean, do you see it changing at all? It seems that he who has the gold makes the rules.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, it doesn't have to be that way. It certainly is that case right now. But, for example, if you look at the period between, right after World War II, so roughly 1945 through about 1976, inequality in America dropped to a relatively low level because our country invested in infrastructure, in education, in health care. I mean, I came from a working class family. I was able to get a good education. College tuition didn't cost nearly as much as it does now. You could buy your first home relatively inexpensively. Today, it's like everything is expensive. Healthcare is expensive. Mm-hmm. Education is expensive. Buying the first house is expensive. And so it's just a lot harder now. And so if we really want to build a strong economy, like, it has to be an economy that everybody is participating in. Otherwise, we're not going to have a successful recovery.
Well, we're running out of time here. I'm sorry. The power went out, so I lost you guys temporarily, and now I'm on my cell phone. But I wanted to thank you, Dr. West, for coming on the show, ask you if there was anything else you wanted to say, and tell you that we hope you'll come back after the election and we can talk some more.
Well, Senator, thank you very much. And Maria, thank you as well. And good luck in your studies. And
thank
sounds
you.
Like you have found a great topic and a topic that we really need to think about very seriously.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well,
and thank you for
Dr.
all
West.
You, the wealth of information that you brought to our program.
Yes, absolutely.
And we also want to thank our listeners, as always, for making us a priority in your life, because there's a lot of noise out there. And we feel real honored that you continue to share our podcast. And, of course, it's a live broadcast at now, but people are sending links, and it's really nice. It's very flattering. The Senator and I are very grateful.
Yes, we are, and we're going to end the show tonight. I look for a lot of songs to pay tribute to our guests. And couldn't decide on one, so you know my rule of thumb, Maria, when in doubt, go with the Beatles. So here's the Beatles, Revolution. Thank you.
Perfect.
We'll see you next week.
Yes.
Give the people their right to vote.